All right, it's DT Systems, dog tested and dog tough. You know, we like that dog in them, baby. We've been using the H2O 1820. Over the last several months, we've been playing with this unit. Our friends at Standing Stone Kennels, Ethan and Kat, they've been using it for years, and we've been playing with it. We really like it. I think for the dog trainer, the hunter, and the guy or gal who's training their dog to get ready for duck season, we'll really enjoy the 1820. Super reliable, super consistent, great unit for you and your dogs. H2O 1820. Dog tested, dog tough. Hashtag man's best kennel. It's Gunner Kennels, baby. It's a kit. We had Addison on the podcast, a phenomenal dude, always innovating our industry. And one of the things that he brought up is it's a kit. It's not just the kennel itself. You've got the fan 2.0 for your summer, right? Like, it's hot out. We got to keep that dog cool. In wintertime, you got the all weather kit. Keeps that core body temperature in there so the dog doesn't have to work as hard to stay warm. They also have the magnetic door accessory that keeps that body temperature in there. And then the straps. Everybody thinks like, oh, I'll just go to Home Depot and get the cheapo straps. Well, listen, they developed these straps so that basically you can lift a VW bug with the two straps. So if you were to get in a car accident on the way to the duck blind or the training grounds, that dog is going to be beyond strapped and stay safe. Check it out. Gunner Kennels, baby. Slide in the DMs. We'll hook you up. Force fetch. What is it? It's super intimidating to so many people, yet it's not that difficult. I built a step-by-step process that helps you understand it. You and your dog can be successful in it, and it takes the intimidation away of the process so that you and your dog can get to your goals. That's what it's built for. Let me teach you how I do it so that you and your dog can do it. Different breeds, different personalities, problem solving, and more. Check it out. Links in the description. The Force Fetch course, baby.
On the simple stuff, which is control, and over the basics, you know, the dog, if you ain't gonna teach it to mark the week of training, it's just not gonna happen. But we can teach it to sit there and be steady and hope to build a little confidence by being steady. And that's the one thing I always, even on a regular weekend test, steadiness is key to me. If the dog ends up not marking or goes out because it failed on a blind, you know, that's one thing, but we can get the dog to sit. Essentially, if we're going to sign it up, it should sit.
All right, what's up, buddy? Everybody, I'd like to welcome to the show first time guest Carter Turner from Mossy Pond down in Georgia. Man, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us. Do me a favor, take a second and tell everybody a little bit about yourself.
Hi, Bob. Nice having me on. My name's Carter Turner, and I'm from Patterson, Georgia, a small town in southeast Georgia, about an hour and a half north of Jacksonville. Been training dogs full-time for 7 years on competitions and been glad to, you know, move up from throwing birds before that and now running the big show with y'all guys. I got a wife and two kids, Waylon, who is 4, and Kip, who's 10 months old, and both of them are ready and eager to be in the dog game, but you know, maybe they won't take my job from me. So that's the big thing so far.
That's awesome, man. Yeah, you had a wild upbringing. I mean, you've been doing this. You've been in the dog game since like middle school. Tell us about that.
Yep. So when I was growing up, my cousin had a dog being trained at Mossy Pond by Brad Arrington. And I kind of just went out there with him and threw birds for him. And we'd spend a bunch of time out there watching him do gun dogs. And when he got into the derbies, it really sparked my interest in going to run competitions. And I was like, so I went with him to a couple of competitions and then spent my summers in New York, in Marlboro, New York, and just really fell in love with the competition game. And that really made a, you know, impact on where I wanted to go. I ended up going to college at University of Georgia, but that was just for my mom's sake. She really wanted me to have a degree. I knew the whole time I was going home to train dogs. Ended up graduating and going straight home to train for Brad.
Very good. So how old were you when Brad was like, all right, man, well, do you want to get paid and throw birds?
I was 16 whenever I got paid for the first time. My first year of college, I would spend the summers. that's when I officially did it like full time for, you know, a couple months. But during the, I would go there every now and then. I threw for a couple hunt tests too, for him, that they had some little HRC tests, and, you know, made a quick extra buck. But really, I was probably 18, 19 years old when I first started truly going on the road with him and seeing the whole world and how big this game really is, that it's just not here in Patterson, Georgia.
That's awesome. So that, when you saw the competitions, that's when it was like light bulb moment. This is what I'd like to do.
Absolutely. And you know, growing up duck hunting and running rabbit dogs and coon hunting, I was real competitive in the coon hunting game and turned it over to the duck hunting as soon as I found out there was competitions. I love winning. Winning is ultimate goal. So I rolled into, when I found out there was something I can go and compete at and be successful at, that's when I was sparking my big interest on it.
Can we talk about the coon hunting game for other people, but also honestly, just for me, like, that sounds awesome. What did you do? What kind of dogs you're running? What does that look like?
So one of my uncles, he was doing it. And, you know, obviously I was one of the youngest guys, about 60 years probably in there. And but I loved it. And we used tree and walkers, but it was blue tick coon hounds and red bones and black and tans. And they have little cast, and you go out with four dogs at a time, turn them out. And you have to know your dog's bark for when they just trailing, then you have to know their tree bark. It's two different types of barks, and you call them. There's a point system involved. And then after 60 minutes of hunting, whoever has the most points wins. And it's all a cash prize. You pay money to enter, and you win the pot at the end.
Is that where people get the Grand Knight champion?
So that would be on the UKC side. I participated more in the PKC. PKC actually pays out, where UKC is just more like a hunt test, just a pass or fail type thing. You get a ribbon.
Gotcha.
But the coonhound world is very, very competitive.
Is it really?
Yeah, it's very. We traveled all the way. You know, we went up north. I've been Ohio, Kentucky, running events. And there's a lot of competitive people in the coonhound events.
That's really cool. I feel like when I see other events, beagles, coon dogs, you know, you even like the professional bite dog sports. I mean, those are they are professionals, right? But I don't see rigs like what we've got.
No, we got a whole different level of rigs and of money tied into it. But I think also our value of our dogs are probably a little higher simply because of the way we treat them. It was a mental thing. Them coon dogs, you know, most of them living on a chain out in the yard. When's the last time you seen your Grand Hunt and Retriever champion or SRS champion laid out in the yard on a chain? You don't see that.
No, it's a good point. Yeah, it's just one of those things where I'm just even talking like, I haven't dabbled in it as a trainer, but like I'll commentate for a bite dog sport competition. I guess the way you would equate it is it's the SRS of the bite dog sports, and I'll go out there and commentate for it. And you know, it's two gunner kennels or very kennels in a van, and it's like four or five dogs for that trainer, and it's a lot of times their personal dog that they take to the high level, and then it's like, you know, they have people come and day train with them or whatever, where, you know, these dogs with us stay with us year round, 10 months out of the year. You know, it's just a little bit different.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're also being with our companions, our lifestyle. These dogs can live inside with you and be your best friend. And, you know, the bite dogs, of course, can, but on the coon hunting world, most of them are only used to coon hunt. They're not laying in there with you. You know, they're probably going to have an open style dog box in the back of your truck. Or if you're up north, you'll have one that can close the doors on it. But you're just going to be in a little two or three hole box in the back of the truck. Definitely ain't no Ainley or deer skin back there, though.
Yeah, no. I wish our stuff wasn't so dang expensive, bud.
I know it. I could have something new then.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So did you have your own coon dogs or was it your uncle's?
No, I started off just tagging along with him and ended up buying my own coon dogs and, you know, chase the pedigrees. And it's kind of funny. It's all the same as labs. We all look for pedigree and how we like this marking and different stuff. Well, the same thing with coon dogs is, you know, there's different ones that trail better and different ones that tree this, and some run farther, and some go off hunting by themselves and won't hunt with the pack. There's different little things they're looking for. So I was big into finding the right one. I had a really nice dog I made to a silver champion, and there's three levels of bronze, silver, and platinum. And then when I finally got out of it, when I started training Labradors, I figured I couldn't chase dogs around all day and all night. So I better pick one.
That's fair. What do you look for, or did you look for in the pedigree for, like, I want this in my coon dog?
So I was big into the wipeout tree and walkers, and the wipeout is the bloodline. And the main thing I looked for was the dog can solo hunt. So you need a dog that'll go off and tree by himself and won't stick with a pack and back up other dogs. That's how you get more points, essentially, is by treeing by yourself. So one that had to have a good nose, can trail something that's maybe an older track, but then end up getting off and running it by himself.
Do you feel like the training for that was a good foundation? Foundation may not be the right word, but like a good transition into more of the lab world?
I think the key to it was learning how to spend time with dogs and read dogs. Half of our job as Labradors is being able to read a dog and using the different type of ways to train the dog based off of what we're seeing him do. So the same thing with the coon dogs. I can train when I was working them and, you know, doing different things. I could read the dog when he left the box on, well, maybe I should try this, or put him on more hot buckets, or maybe get a live coon in front of him. Different stuff where, same with the lab, you know, as soon as we let him out the box, we know we can look at her feeling. Do we need to throw a fun bumper before we start, or do we need to maybe do some corrections, some force fetch or something? Just reading dogs was very critical there, and is today too.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think it probably built Kevin used the word foundation, but the foundation of being with an animal and understanding what it is probably going to do before it does it, just by looking at its mannerisms, its body language, and then reading the timing of things, it probably laid a great foundation for you.
Yep. And, you know, taking care of them. You know, I had rabbit beagles at the same time that I just piddled with, and mainly had just three or four of them. And, you know, the health care of dogs and taking them and cleanliness and making them the best they can possibly, because if they feel the best, they'll run the best. Same with the Labradors. Now, you know, the better I take care of my labs, the better they're going to perform for me. I'm asking them to go out and do a lot. So I want them to be in the best health and the best shape they can be in at all times.
Yeah, I agree. Absolutely. So what were some of those dogs, the coon dogs, what were they named? I always get a kick out of that.
Well, they're not nearly as unique as these Labrador names get on the papers. A lot of them are just the actual call name. But I had one dog named Belle. I can't remember her. She was a blue tick coon hound, and she was very nice, except she had literally chewed through hot wire to get out the kennel. So she was on a chain most of the time. And I had the dog that I made the silver champion was Wipeouts Threesomes Trip. And he's the one who really took me the farthest, and I enjoyed hunting him the most. But, you know, I had a dog directly off of Hairy Balls. they had Hairy Balls, and they had Silent Balls, and all different types of balls. And so you had to keep the ball's name in there. So we moved on, and I think, I can't remember the exact paper name. We called him Cujo, but he was something, I don't even remember exactly, something balls, though.
I think I need to keep that in the back of my head.
I was just going to say, what are we doing for, we got a litter on the ground right now. And
yeah, it's Hairy Balls on you.
We might need to adopt that.
Fantastic, dude. Well, awesome. Now we're 19, 20. We're in college, and you're spending your summers with Brad. Is still throwing birds, correct?
Correct. And I did do, you know, the start. He showed me some leash work and just running some gun dogs here and there, but no real training, mainly just throwing birds.
Okay. When did you kick into, like, all right, Carter, this is your group of dogs, and we're going to teach you how to get them from A to B?
So as soon as I graduated college, I graduated in the winter semester of 2016. So January of 17, I guess. This is going on 7 years now, about to be 7 years. I got to start at Mossy Pond, and I was an apprentice, basically, under a guy named Mac Boatwright, and he showed me from the ground up. And I thought I was going to move straight into the big dogs and get to run and watch Brad on the derbies. And I was like, man, this is easy. You know, you sit up there and just call their names and go get them, blow the whistle. And the first week or two, I think all I did was touch a wonder lead. And I was like, whoa, this is different. And then I learned that. And then moved into the force fetch game, and then moved on all the way through the, I had 1 year of doing that. And then I went out and started running competitions the very next year.
Okay. What are some things that you learned in that foundation year, that building blocks of taking a dog from zero to hero, that you would pass on to someone starting out?
So the first thing I noticed was how the first 2 weeks was probably the most important 2 weeks to me. When the dog got, so a dog gets dropped off at 5 to 6 months old, you can't go straight into just putting a rope on them or putting a collar on them and training them. There was a 2 week span that we got the dog adjusted to being in the kennel environment, being with me, becoming buddies with it. And I learned, I thought, you doing, when I first started, you just get the dog, you start training them, let it go. But now it's, you know, let's take some time. Even when me and Lee switch dogs back and forth between each other sometimes, I'll spend a week or two with them on a fully trained dog to just get used to them. And, you know, you said, Carter, here, run this master dog, I'd want him a month ahead of time just to be able to get acclimated to him and let him get comfortable with me and my lifestyle. And then we'll move on, and then we can get to training. The same way with, you know, when them little young dogs is most important, I wanted to build an attitude and make them as happy as possible about retrieving, because essentially we're going to knock it down and build them all the way back up the way we want to build them up.
Yeah, I agree. I think sometimes, I'll be honest, I think sometimes we can forget that. You know, it's like wham, bam, not wham, bam, thank you, ma'am, in terms of not caring, but it's like, all right, hey, you know, let's get rolling. Let's get doing the leash work. Let's get going. And we've got to slow down so that later on we can speed up, build a good relationship, build that retrieve drive. I mean, some of them that come here don't even know what a fun bumper is. And if they do, they don't bring it back and they're running all over the field. And your first instinct is like, you got to be kidding me. Here we go. But that's part of it. And I think that's a really important key to remember.
The first thing I do is the first thing I do, and I actually got two puppies right now that we're working with, and my bird boy is wanting to become more of a started dog trainer. So I'm trying to teach him a little bit. And, you know, we got two puppies just dropped off that are 5 months old. I went and got clip wing quail. We put them on a long leash, and I said, look, I want you to walk about 200 yards with them, and every 50 yards, just play with this quail with them. Let him chase him. And I just let him do that on a long leash. There's no heeling, there's no sitting, nothing like that. Just let him play and let him walk. And the dog got real good. The first day that one of the dogs was real good, but the other one was real nervous about walking on that leash. By the end of it, 2 days later, she was just moving flawlessly on it. But we use that bird to, you know, hop around and chase it. Oh man, it really turns them on.
Absolutely. Let the light bulb click. Let the light bulb click.
Yep. And then they want to start training.
Exactly. Then they'll start wanting to work. I think that would be phenomenal if owners who did that before we got them to some degree, where it's like they have been on a leash, they have been on a check cord, they have been swimming. Nothing has to be perfect. I'm not asking for, you know, a perfect 6-month-old puppy to come here, but, you know, just acclimate them to life.
Absolutely. Yeah. And we get dogs of all types down here, and I'm sure you do too. Everybody does. We get dogs that have literally been bought at 8 weeks old and been put in a pen and fed and watered, and that's all they've ever been done. They maybe let out every now and then. They hardly can catch them, don't know their names. And then we get the ones that are, you know, the person has done everything with, and they ride in the truck and go to work with them and everything else. So, you know, we get a little both ends, but that's the key to it. Just like I said, while I go, you got to be able to read the dog and know, all right, I can go a little faster, I can push this dog a little harder, or I might need to slow down a little bit and take my time. And it all pans out in the end.
100%. It does. I kid around about it once in a while. Like if we have a problem dog or a challenge or something going on, my comment is they don't have a choice but to figure it out. At some point, due to sheer will of us training and doing it, they don't have a choice but to figure out how to sit down and mark and pick up a blind and da 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 da. Like, it's gonna happen. It may not be they're gonna do it.
Yep. It might not pass the test, but they'll go pick that duck up because they don't have no other option for us.
That's right. That's right.
Now, Carter, do you mostly do, at least right now, are you mostly doing like hunt test dogs and things like that? Or are you doing a lot of like gun dog, people want you to train the dog to be just a hunting dog sort of thing?
In our system, I'm pretty much only touching competition dogs. I do piddle with a few, and I say piddle, I do train a few gun dogs. Mainly right now I'm doing it just to help my bird boy become a trainer. So I have a couple of gun dogs that where I'm helping him, and we're going to put all the way through the transition level. But I keep 25 competition dogs pretty much year round. I do a lot of, this time of year, I do a lot of fun stuff with them. I take them hunting. And at Mossy Pond, we have a plantation style preserve. We have upland pheasant, upland quail, duck hunting. And we have all types of duck hunting pit blinds. And then you're, so I will take actually my clients' dogs hunting for them. So that's half of our training right now.
That sounds really stressful.
Doing the hunting style stuff.
That sounds pretty tough, man. If you if you need someone to come take that burden, yeah, I'm free.
Yeah, I've hunted 4 or 5 different dogs, you know, in the past few weeks that, you know, I'm like, dang, you're 7 grand passes. How are you not doing this? But, you know, I'm asking them to do something they've never done before. But, you know, the owners are, I think it's rewarding for the dogs. They've worked for the last 10 months. They've worked their tail off for me and went all over the country and done everything I've asked of them. So it's good for me to put some birds in front of their face too.
Absolutely. We're going to get into that a little bit later about dogs' first hunts, no matter how well trained they are. But I want to hear about your successful fall, man, and we'll banter a little bit about our camaraderie at Flight H. But you had, so you ran the Grand, then the SRS, or was it the SRS, then the Grand?
So I run the SRS first, and then the Grand, and then straight to the National. I went home on a Sunday from the SRS, left on Wednesday for the Grand, come home from it, and left the following, I came home on it on a Wednesday, left on Sunday for the National.
No joke, I don't envy that.
You know, the way it worked out, I'll do it again if I can do it the same way.
Yeah, really? Why is that?
Well, anytime you get to win the crown to start off all the national events, you know, and then still have a pretty good grand and a pretty good national, it really makes it a lot easier. And, you know, you got to have a family, a good family at home, and, you know, good kennel help and everything else. That makes the world go around too, because, you know, we get to go out. Essentially, we're out there having fun, even though it's our job, but we ain't none of us doing it if we don't love it. So I love going out there and hanging out with everybody just as much as I do being at home.
Absolutely. Boom. When Kevin and I go into the duck blind together, you know that we're packing the bismuth, baby. Man, when I've got to pull up on a old Drake Millard, I want to make sure that if my aim is true, that duck goes down. And I am slinging the bismuth at him, baby. Check him out. Kent Cartridge. Bismuth. At it this duck season. Hey, it's not only the food that fuels the truck of Lone Duck, but we also worry about that gut health. Sometimes the dogs get a little bit of rumbling in the tummies, and I like to help them out get all balanced with this product that Purina provides called Fortiflora. Basically a probiotic, and you sprinkle a little bit of these pouches on the dog's food. So for instance, if I'm driving to a hunt test and they're rattling around on the trailer, and you know, sometimes their stomachs can get a little upset from stress, movement, anything, that Fortiflora can really help balance them out, get them back to feeling good, and get ready to run. So check it out. It's Purina's Fortiflora. Boom. Let's talk about the SRS, man. I've ran one in my career, something I'd consider dabbling in more in the future, but explain to people what the Super Retriever Series is. I know we've talked about it, so we don't have to do a 20-minute dissertation on the SRS, but what it is and then the crown and how it all went down for you.
So just a quick on the Super Retriever Series, you know, it's basically all the hunt tests and field trials combined. It's one series of field trial and one style of hunting, and it could be AKC or HRC in the first two series. And then you move into the third and fourth series, which one of them two series, generally the fourth, is what they call a hunt savvy, and that's where they do basically anything and everything. They can throw five or six at one time, put you in a dog hut. It's supposed to be simulated hunting environment. Your field trial series is, you know, it can be anywhere from a Q to a very hard derby, or all, we've even run some very open style stuff that, you know, just some very big opens. And the hunt test is generally, it just kind of plays by ear. Sometimes it's HRC style, just depending on the judges. The judges kind of lead way to that. Going into the crown turns into five series, and it's still the first two series, one a hunt test and one a white coat series. And after that, it's pretty much judge's choice.
Gotcha. So but, this year, how many did you take to the crown?
So this year I qualified 8 dogs for the crown. I had 2 more that only needed 1 point, barely missed them. And my 8 dogs were, I had a very good crew. I won team of the year and got second and third. So I had Shooter and then Cappy and Smack. And
what is it? All my dogs be were, team of the year. What does that even mean?
So team of the year means every event, they first put the winner gets 6 points. And the loser, the 6th place dog gets 1 point. The loser don't get nothing. But so the 6th place dog gets 1 point. And to qualify for the crown, you have to have 4 points. Well, over the year, Shooter had 29 points, and he won team of the year this year. I ran 14 total events, and Shooter ran 9 of them. He only didn't place in 1 event.
Wow. Yep. What a hammer.
He had 3 wins. Cappy had 2 wins. Smack had 1 win. I had 8 total wins this past season out of the 14. One event, I had multiple events. I had 3 or 4 placements. Had a very good year, and, you know, had a lot of confidence going into the crown, and ended up doing pretty well there.
What does it take to be a great SRS dog?
So somebody asked me this the other day, and I told them that you have to be able to mark. Essentially, you have to be able to mark, because they're going to throw hidden retired guns. They're going to throw birds that you can barely see. So you have to be able to mark everything you see. But also, the dog has to be compliant enough to, all right, work with me. I know you didn't see it over there. Let me point you in there, and you still go find it. Let me cast you off a poison bird. The dog has to be extremely compliant with you, but it still has to have that natural ability to mark. At the end of the day, you have to be able to mark.
That's unreal, man. How old is your average SRS dog?
My youngest dog is just turned 3 this year, a few months ago, and my oldest dog was 10. Ooh. And I had my 10-year-old, he got 5th in the crown. I got 2 8-year, the winner was 7, 8. So I imagine I think the average crown champion for over time is 7 years old, 8 years old. And my average dog was 7 years old, you know, and they've always been in training. These dogs have been in training forever.
Yeah. I guess why I asked that question is, you know, the classic, I got a master title or a HRCH at 2 years old, you know, that's awesome. That's a great accomplishment. I don't encourage people to rush to get a title by a certain age. So caveat that. But the point I'm trying to make is the things that these dogs have to learn, comprehend, be exposed to, be comfortable with, and have so many reps under their belt of the poison birds that are just so tempting, and the confidence to go out there and hammer the marks and then the poison birds and then the goofy hunt savvy stuff that they can throw at you. I mean, that's not a 2-year-old. I guess it could be, but the maturity level and life experience needs to be there.
Absolutely. And it's really a good, we call it a 4-year-old game. When the dog turns 4, they're probably getting into beginning SRS for us. I run a little 3-year-old. She qualified for the crown, but we kind of bounced around on the events with her and just let her. She's a really exceptional dog, but we still didn't push her very hard. The one thing about a dog is they have to do the basics. They have to be able to retrieve, run a blind, just like you do a master test. The national, no different. Master national, but you know that. Field trial, the same in the SRS. You have to do that. But also, the dog has to be just just enough, mature enough to be when they throw them silly situations at you and they throw all the tricky stuff, that it can be like, you know what, I need to just stick to the basics and just do it and not get phased by it. The ones that are not mature or haven't, even some of the older ones that are not experienced enough, you know, they blows their mind when they do some of the tricks and stuff they do.
Yeah. How do you get a dog comfortable with the tricks?
So one thing that was always told to me was never train for the tricks, but, you know, and just always stick to the basics. I do a bunch of it, but I do every once a week, I throw the tricks at them. In training, I'll do we call it Tricky Wednesday, and we throw everything we can at them. We do, you know, outgoing diversion is a trick, essentially. We throw crazy poison birds that, you know, the dogs should not be able to do. And we don't, any type of trick, we do not use any type of correction on it. You know, it's just, we try to coach the dog through it and get them through the situation. And the only thing we'll correct on is basics. If they don't do the basic stuff, then we, you know, we can get a correction. Outside of that, we're all fun and trying to teach it to them. And I'm talking about 8-year-old dogs. We're teaching it to them.
Yeah, and I would say what you're implying with the basics, meaning stopping on a whistle, going when sent, yep, et cetera, you know, breaking or something stupid like that.
Can you give me an example? Sorry, of like the tricky stuff that you're talking about, like what you maybe encountered in this year's SRS?
So some of the stuff we do is like remote sends, you know, and I know that's not, but we're talking throw a poison bird out in front of you, then make you do a remote send blind across from you and then maybe throw some outgoing diversions. All the different keyholes we have to hit, these dogs have to hit different type of decoys. They need to understand what two decoys look like. And I think these dogs are smart enough. The ones that are actually really good at this game, they look out there and they can picture two decoys that are supposed to be a keyhole. Just simple stuff like that. Or we might have three guys sitting in a chair shooting a gun, and then you have to walk away from the chair and cast the dog on a blind past the mark. Just all the different crazy stuff they come up with.
Yeah. Just blow their mind enough, but help them through it so that they're comfortable if it happens.
Yeah, and we don't have to train for the exact situation, but, you know, just anytime you take a dog to an odd situation and just coach them through it, that makes them more comfortable even in other situations. Like a little puppy taking them around a loud noise for the first time. You know, the more you do that with them, it don't have to be the same noise. It can be another loud noise later on, but they're still going to be more comfortable with it. The same in these. We're just putting them in any odd situation. We'll have, you know, different loud collars out there, electronic collars sitting beside us, so the dog's kind of freaking out. And all we're doing is throwing singles for them. But there'll be a loud goose collar going off beside us, just the different stuff like that that you normally don't do for hunt test training.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so you kind of kicked ass.
I did. I had a good event.
Walk us through it, man. Walk us through the whole deal. Like, how did it feel going into it?
Well, going into it, I was confident. There was still a little nerve, I think, when I got there. But when I left the house, I knew I was going to win that thing. That was the whole goal. We worked hard all year. We went to a bunch of different states to practice and prepare. And, you know, we was going to win. When the first dog ran, I had a pretty good score. And I said, it kind of took the nerve off. I think if I would have, you know, went out there and blew up on the first dog, it might would have just been a tank, because the dogs can feel my nerves too. So luckily I settled in pretty quick and ended up doing pretty good. Had a bunch of dogs toward the front. After the second series, they cut to 18 dogs and I carried 5 of the 18. So I had 5 of my 8 going to the third. And then had a really nice third series again and carried 4 of them to the fourth. So 4 of the 12. And then they cut to the top 6.
Let's go to the third series. What was the third series setup?
So the third series, the first series was the hunt test. The second series was the field trial, big field trial. And the third series, we had 2 blinds. One was remote, and then one was on the, both of them were poison birds. You had a remote send land blind, and then from the same spot that the dog ran from, you run a down the shore water blind with 2 points of land in play. And on the second point, they had a poison bird planted that was shining like a diamond over there. And, you know, in the running water, it was tough. There was a bunch of people pick up the poison birds, and we had a good outing in there. A lot of that's to the control of the dogs. I had one dog pick up the poison bird. A couple of them give me a good scare, but all the rest of them did a really nice job.
All right, fourth series. Yep. How many did you take to that?
So the fourth, I carried four dogs to the fourth series, and they had a hybrid series set up. And in the hybrid series, they had, when you got to the mat, or you actually stood in front of a banded chair, and they had a, I think it was over 300 yards watermark, a lot of land. You go through a little channel and run a lot on land, and then you hit the post to hit the water again. And they had a retired field trial mark. They threw it, and then you sat down in the chair and you called for a double, and you shot the gun beside them. You blew your duck call, and they threw a double, and you picked it up. And unfortunately, I had every dog backside the long gun on the field trial butt, where the judges didn't ding us too bad, and it led them right to the bird. So we ended up coming out of there pretty good. I carried three dogs to the finals out of that series, three of the six.
I feel like on a long retired like that, you know, they do their best to mark where that bird came from. So real quick to break this down, you know, if you don't know, a retired gun, a retired bird is a mark that's thrown that the dog sees the person, sees the mark, and then as they're running a blind or picking up other marks, that person goes and hides. So when they come back, they look out there to go find that person that threw it, and they're no longer there. Okay. So now you send them out there into basically no man's land that they should have marked off of. And then depending on how people set things up, like maybe you've got one hay bale that they're retired behind. Well, if that dog's a good dog, they're going to say, I saw it on this side of the hay bale and stay to that side of the hay bale. But a lot of these like good judges will hide them where there isn't much to mark off of. And so backsiding it, you know, it's kind of, they went to the area, and is it really a backside? Technically, like it is, but you know, they're out there and they're in the area.
Correct. And on this situation, they hide, you know, at 300 yards, they hid behind a bush, a big bush out there that was up on the backside of a pond dam that also had a ditch going underneath it with water. So either way, the dog wasn't really cheating water. They were just hitting the wrong piece of water. But when they got through the ditch, they got up on the backside of the pond dam, and they'd run down there and get it. And I think only two dogs actually, what I'd call, picked up clean. Another dog went really wide in the water, but ended up having a massive hunt. All the dogs that went right behind the gun, though, went right to the bird. But still, you know, we call it behind the gun, but essentially it's not a bad spot to be most of the time.
Sure. Yeah, I get it. All right, so now you're taking three to the finals. Who was in the finals competing against you?
So I had, just on my dogs, I had Shooter, Zeus, and Cappy. And then Lyle had Hatch, and Justin Hergert had Cash, and Bobby Wills had, I can't remember which one he had. He had one there too. That was the six dogs there. And then going into the series, I was in the lead with Cappy, and we fortunately held on to it at the end of it. It was a big, big hunt savvy series. You sat down and blew the duck call, and then you had to walk off and go rearrange a decoy. When you rearranged the decoy, they threw a splash bird right out in front of you while the dog was in a mud hut the entire time. And then you walked back to the dog, and you sat down, and you had some bubba gunners sitting in a boat behind you, and you blew the duck call. They blew their duck calls, and then they threw a couple more birds out there. And the first thing, you picked up one bird, and you was hoping it was the little splash bird up front. So basically, we primary selected. It was floating out in the water. And then you noted them off and ran a blind past all of them. So we ran a poison bird blind that had a big re-entry off of a dike. And a lot of dogs were sucking right. And big wind, big open water to the left. Really nice placement of blind. And then you come back up and you picked up your other three marks. So it was four marks total and one blind.
Interesting. So during this all, are you like racking points in your head? How are you keeping things together to be like, I think we're doing all right. What do we need to do to stay in the lead?
To start with my first dog, I didn't really try to count points when we come in sixth place. So there was really no reason to try to count points. We were just trying to do the best we can do and figure out the test for our other two dogs. I got up there and Zeus did a pretty nice job. I did have to handle on one mark, but I can keep up with the score generally in my head based off of handles and how the hunts go and how the judges have been judging in the previous series. But, you know, it's hard to count the whistles and stuff like that. So I knew as much as I could, but I didn't go into depth. Now with Shooter, he was my second dog I ran. I kind of watched a couple other people run. I said, all right, I need to handle, you know, no, I can't have a big hunt or I don't need to handle and stuff like that. So luckily I didn't have to handle and I could easily, I was counting it up pretty good. And then with Cappy, I kept the score. I knew what I couldn't do. I knew if I had a good blind and did not handle, I would win easily. If I had a good blind and handled, but I had a really quick handle, I should still have it secured.
It's a lot more strategy, right? Like, I feel like this is how I go into it when I was running some of the Qs this summer. You know, at least for me, when I was, hunt test is pass fail. I'm excited that everybody passes. I don't really watch anybody else run unless it's one of my buddies and we're there to like root them on or bust their chops. You know, me and Blaine are typically busting each other's chops when we're at the hunt test. But when you're at the queue, you're watching what everybody else is doing so that you can see where the dog's winding the bird. You're watching how they're handling on the blinds. And it's not a point system like the SRS, but in essence, you're like, okay, that dog smoked it. That dog, meh. That dog, meh. And then you're like, okay, the one who smoked it, that's who I've got to, you know, be better than. And so going into the four series of a queue, you know, I'm thinking, I really obviously don't want to have to handle, where do I need to point the dog? How do I do this? And it's very strategic compared to the hunt test is it's strategic to pass, strategic to win. I got to get it good enough to pass versus I've got to hammer it. And how do I hammer it? And I feel like since I don't have the savvy that you do and Mossy Pond's team has had at the SRSs and like the Clarks and the Lyles and the Stevens. I mean, you guys have so much more experience at the SRS that I feel like I would be at a disadvantage. Even if you and I had two great dogs, let's just say they're two equal dogs, you would have such an advantage over me because of the experience at the line as the handler.
I do think that does play a big deal. And, you know, coming into the year, I only ran two events last year, just kind of dabbling in it. And then this year, I went full force. But the first two events this year were the same exact dogs I ran all year long. I carried dogs to the semifinals, but never made a final in the first two events. And then it just started clicking. And a lot of that's experience. I got better as a handler. I knew what I could allow and not allow the dogs to do, even though, yes, what, you know, my dog was doing good work, but it wasn't good enough work. Then I learned how to control the dogs a little better. But at the same time, you know, just like we're talking about counting the score in our head, essentially all we got to do is go out there and do the best we can do. If we count the score, get too worried about, well, I should have handled because everybody else was handling, then we're not going out there doing the best we can do. I want to go out there every time. And if the dogs try to eliminate points as much as possible, so if I know that handling quick is better, then when I go up there, you know, I'll give the dog, I still want my dog to mark the bird and find it on his own. And if it's just don't win, we mark every bird and we don't win, we just don't win. But if I know I could have handled when he missed the bird instead of letting him put on a big hunt, then I feel a little worse about it because I knew the judges like a quick handle. Or if I know the judges like to see him work it out, then, you know, you got the opportunity to let that happen too. That's the disadvantage of not running enough events. But, you know, you got two good dogs and, you know, the handlers are essentially the same on lining them up. You know, it's about who can go get it.
Very cool. So Cappy won.
Yep.
Congratulations, man. What did that feel like?
Oh, Cappy was the first dog I trained that I said, you know, I could really win the crown. And I didn't have Shooter at the time. Lee Howard was running him, and which were teammates. And but Cappy, when he first arrived at Mossy Pond, he come straight to me, and I was like, you know, this is, he was good. I knew he was good. I watched everybody else run the SRS. I watched the Crown for years on the television, and I said, man, this dog can do it. So I had a lot of faith in him, and he won the my first two events I won, he won them back-to-back weeks. So, you know, I was really confident with him. And then, man, it was good to see him win, because, you know, he essentially had no hunt test career before. He was started in the field trial with somebody else. But I ended up teaching him all the hunt tests and, you know, breaking him down. And me and him learned together at the same time. He was learning the SRS game, and I was too. And for us to stick it out all year, it was like a weight lifted off our shoulder.
Good for you, man. What a badass. Then, so first place was you. Who got second place?
Second place was Justin Hergert and Cash. And third place was me and Shooter again. Yep. And then I think Lyle got fourth. And me and Zeus got fifth. And Bobby and I can't remember who he had, but they got sixth.
Well, congrats. I mean, that's a freaking hammer of a SRS, man. Like, you and Mossy Pond must have been ecstatic. Your clients had to have been pumped. I mean, like, they better throw you a dang party.
We're going to do something. No, it was great because Cappy's owner got to come watch it. He lives in Louisiana, so he was there and drove back and forth every day and watched it. So I was glad for Mr. Brian to be able to come watch his dog. And, you know, it's a great feeling for me, but it's even better for him to know that all his money paid back off for him, that, you know, that I'm actually doing my work.
Good for you. Yeah, absolutely. That's the cool part about SRS too, is it's got a payout, man.
Oh yeah.
What is it? Writing checks that your butt can't cash. You cashed them, bud.
That's right. That's right. We hope to do it again next year. We're already preparing, you know, we got some up and coming dogs coming up that essentially now I feel like, well, you know, we got the best eight dogs. And we got about 12 to 15 dogs, potential SRS dogs. And, you know, you got to beat our truck to be even just to get on the weekend. So, you know, I hope to, like, my goal next year is to carry double digit dogs to the Crown. I had eight this year. I want to at least get 10 next year.
Good for you. Setting goals. I like it. So then you go from the Crown to the Grand. And the Grand, at least my opinion, is it's a butt kicker, man. You know, people get cut pretty quick. How did it go for you?
Here I went 6 for 9 at the Grand. Had a pretty good Grand. It was rough at first. I first series I did a lot of handling, and I just didn't think I did very well. Second series I survived, but you know, the few dogs that did well in the first, they kind of got, we call it dinged up, but essentially they just got marked down, but still playing. And we held on in the third and fourth series. I lost one dog in the fourth series that I felt very, very bad for. One of my good friends, and I call him Grandpa. His name's Dan Caton. He trains with me every day. And I lost his dog in the fourth series. Now to put her in the Hall of Fame with that pass. So, but we're going to go back after it in the spring. There's no hard feelings on it. And, you know, the Grand, it can break you down really quick. It can make you hurt and cry and want to give up, yeah. But it will humble you real quick. Coming off a Crown championship and then going straight there, I was like, wow, okay. So we had to bear down, and we essentially got it done. It was a really tough Grand. The weather conditions were tough.
Hey, LoneDuckOutfitters.com is another great way to support the show. If you want to get a hat, you want to get a little swaggy swag, check it out, LoneDuckOutfitters.com. That's another place you can support the show and show up to a hunt test repping the gear. I just had something buzz on my computer. So with the Grand, you took what, eight dogs to the SRS, you said, and nine dogs to the Grand. How many of those SRS dogs went to the Grand?
One.
Which one?
Shooter went to the Grand.
Did he pass?
He did pass. Actually, two. I had Fly did not pass. I was thinking one did not. So I had two dogs. Shooter passed, and Fly did not pass the Grand. She's the little 3-year-old Shooter. That was Shooter's fifth Grand pass.
Nice. Congrats. So I guess with that kind of leads me down the road of like why. So Cappy didn't run the Grand?
No. Cappy, he has his HRCH title and just his owner don't, he's not interested in the Grand as much. Essentially, he's a SRS only. And a couple of my other ones, they went home for duck season. Okay. I think the guys went home. Two of my dogs, they went home for the goosey, early goose and all that. So, you know, that's why they don't. And I had another one that Zeus is 10 years old. He we're lucky to still be able to run him in the SRS. We're not trying to push the owners too much to run everything. He did run the national.
Yeah, he and Memphis, I think, were like back to back. And it's just like two old dogs watching them grin and bear it was. For me, Memphis, I think I cried from the second series on. I think I cried a little bit at the line, and I'm okay with saying it.
Oh man, and Zeus is one of them dogs that, you know, being 10 years old, and I think all 10 year olds that are playing the national level, and they're giving us everything they got. They obviously are pretty good if they're 10 years old still playing.
Yes, they still got it, but man, it was just you could see like I could see Zeus running, and he's tired. You know, he's just. He's still giving it 110%, but what was he at five? He'd have been kicking up dirt, and they just can't kick up dirt anymore.
Yep. And back in February, earlier this year, I thought we was going to have to put Zeus down. And one of my good buddies, and he's a vet here pretty close to us, he got us hooked up. And he got Zeus all doctored up, and we got him on some joint medicine. He felt a little better. And, man, Zeus is – you thought he's 2 years old again for a while, and we had a long road to get qualified for the crown and participate and get points. And man, I was super proud. I was probably just as proud of him getting fifth in the crown as I was Cappy winning it. Like to be 10 years old, it's his first crown and went out there and did that. I was proud of him.
Good. Yeah, dude, it's an amazing feat what we ask these dogs to do. And I don't think people can comprehend it unless they sit there and watch it and go, they just did that. What?
Absolutely. Yes, yeah, it's hard. And for people that, you know, interested in watching the SRS, it is on YouTube to watch. So, you know, you can see some of the crazy stuff we did and some of the series. It's some pretty impressive dog work if you're into the dogs.
Absolutely. All right. So then you had a pretty dang good grand. What do you do pre-grand training that you feel like is different or a tip or a tidbit that you would give?
So one thing I do pre-grand, which everybody, of course, if you don't do it a whole lot, like when we do so much different stuff, is I go straight to throwing from wingers. And I think that helps out with the national too. So all my birds come out with the wingers to get them used to that sound. And I also use it for the grand. I do a bunch of sitting in a chair beside them, the whole dread and time thing and training, terrible. But I do that. But it's all about the dog hitting certain spots on training. So I'll set up where there's a piece of cover in the way. And I cannot allow the dog to cheat the cover. The same thing with water. There's certain aspects I hit, but I hold the dogs to a very high standard in pre-grand training. The grand, they don't give you much time to hunt. You have to go directly to the area to fall and pretty much pick up your bird pretty quick. So I do the same thing in training. I want the dog to go directly to the area to fall. And I don't beat them up. I just re-send and recall. But if I have to get bird help, but a lot of it is thrown with wingers. I think that's the biggest thing is getting them used to seeing no bird boy out here because I use a bird boy every day.
Yeah, same here. I would think that would be my big challenge is transitioning to all hidden guns and like, not just sort of hidden, I mean hidden.
Yeah, exactly. There's no holding line out in the middle of the field. You know, we're putting them, we even go through the whole process of brushing them in and training. We'll carry a machete out there and brush in the blinds because essentially the dog has nothing to mark off of except for, her, you know, the natural landscape. So we do all that and mark the wingers. They need to. We also work really hard on birds that are hard to see for the grand. I think they always throw a bird that is, don't break the skyline with a dark background behind it. There's something always once a grand, there's something So we try to work hard on that.
How I would like to break it down for someone, you know, the dog's looking out into no man's land and they've got to catch a glimpse of a wing, a glimpse of a belly, and the backdrop behind it is dark and the shadows and this and that. And they've got to really work hard to see what they want to see. They've got to want to find that bird out there. And then I would say if they don't see it, now you go. Like if they don't see it, what is the skill set that they have to go and be successful?
Well, one, they have to trust you and lining up on it. I believe, you know, we work hard on birds all year long for the SRS. They throw birds and the grand and even in the Master National, I had dogs not see birds. You know, that you got to be able to talk a dog into a mark at that level. So that dog, one, has to be able to hold a straight line and go where you send him. But it also has to, hey, I might smell something. I might should hunt right here. So it has to have some type of intelligence, not just to keep running on the straight line as well.
Yeah.
That third six of the Master National, I think, I don't know if I had a dog see the right hand bird, the remote send, the first bird out.
Yeah.
It was thrown in that shadow the whole time. I don't know if I had a dog seen it, but they clipped the water and they ran up there and some of them put on a small hunt, some of them pinned it, but they all worked it out.
That's right. All right, let's jump into the National. We were in the same flight together, which was fun because I think I've only ran a hunt test once with you at Stephen Durrance's place. And so we really didn't know each other until this National. It was fun hanging out with you and watching your dogs work. We were in flight H. We had a good group of people. We had Demmer, we had Chase, we had Blaine, we had Oliver, we had Trish. A lot of great amateurs. The tests were tough. Walk us through how many dogs you took, how you did, and you know the challenges that we faced.
Yep. So I took 12 dogs to the National, and I thought I had a really good crew of National dogs. I ended up passing 9 of them, and I was very glad to get them 9 through. It was a tough 5 series.
Yeah, they were.
You know, the first series started off with a poison bird, which is something I'm comfortable with running SRS. So I had a pretty good first series, but it didn't hurt that my first dog I ran was Shooter, which is arguably one of my most talented dogs, and I handled on the go bird. So right off the rip, so I was like, well, okay, here we go. This is not a good start. But we ended up working it out, and he ended up passing. But we got through the first series good, and then that second series, man, that water bird, that was a tough little water bird. I don't know what it was. After a while, it was going left pretty hard. But they all worked it out. I think the key to that, Mark, was the dog had to have just enough common sense to look out there and know that holding blind meant something.
Just get across the pond.
Yeah, if it just get across the pond, don't just run to no man's land. Just run out there to where that holding blind is and hunt it. And that really helped. And I had a really good water blind. I lost one dog there that just totally blew up. She got a little hot after the flyer, had a big gut hunt on the flyer. And then she just went rampage on the flyer, on the long water bird.
Yeah. I lost Ember on the water bird.
Yeah. She went across the water and she was gassed and, you know, just didn't give me a whole lot of effort and caved off to the left. And the next time I seen her, she was way over on the mound. I knew there was no recovery. I tried to give her 2 casts, and yeah, I just brought her on in. There wasn't nothing else to do. And then I lost another one that, you know, I thought should have been called back, but obviously the judges didn't see. And I told somebody, I said, if out of all the dogs I ran that water blind with, he did have the worst blind out of my group. So if I had to drop any, it would have been him. But I still thought it was good enough, but at the end of the day, it wasn't. So there wasn't nothing to argue about. We had to still gear up.
That's right. That's one thing that I would say this National, so this was my third one. I think if I remember correct, this was your first?
This is my second.
Okay, second. So this is my third. I did Shiraw, Idaho, and here in Georgia. And I felt like the first two, and this one, I guess the theme that we would kid around is just survive. You're just surviving. Get to the next series, just survive. So if you got to handle, if you got to do this, you just got to get to the next series. Don't let them blow up. This one, I felt like the first, second, and third series, was tough, man. I felt like there were chances that the dogs didn't get a chance to rebound. They might have done very good work in the first, very good. I'm very good doesn't mean tens. I'm talking sevens and eights, you know, passable good work, no clear screw ups. And then one mark was completely, you're done. You're out. You don't get to do anymore. Where at a normal weekend hunt test or the other nationals that I've seen is like, if the rest were seven and eights and you had a bobble, you know, not a clear out, but a bobble, it'd be like, okay, let's see what he does in the third or the next series. And if there's another bobble, then you're out. And this was more like whacking and stacking, man. You're just out. And I know that some of our buddies there were just like, I mean, call their owners and say, hey, the dog did good work. You know, we did good work. And then they didn't get called back. So they weren't expecting to be dropped. And then they were. That's tough.
Yeah. And I think the judges, I think they were very consistent judging. I think they did a lot of consistency, I think, throughout each series. But I think they had in their mind what they wanted. And, you know, we might have thought it was good and everybody there thought it was good. But if it wasn't, they didn't obviously tell us what they wanted. We figured it out quick.
Yeah.
But I think we didn't do what they wanted, they didn't play around. They went ahead and dropped us.
Yeah.
And that's fine. If that's how it's going to be, we can play that too. But, you know.
Yeah. I don't have hard feelings on it. It is what it is.
No, me either.
I don't at all. I just look at it like, I would like Ember, the one who bobbled the second series. It wasn't good work on that watermark. I know it wasn't, but I also know what she's capable of. So it's like a lot of times judges would in their brain are like, what I think is it showed a lot of promise in other areas. It had a shitty mark. Let's see if it does it again. And if it doesn't do it again, then it just had a brain fart. It had a bad mark. Like it, you know, it's here for a reason, right? Like two-time master national dog at 7 years old. You know what I mean? Like she had one bad mark. It was bad. And I would have loved the opportunity to play one more round. And if she screwed up one more time, then I would have been absolutely good as gold saying, yeah, she didn't earn it this year. But it is what it is, man.
Yep, I agree. You know, the dog just, it was a little choppy getting into the water. And rightfully so, I thought I did a good job. It was running dead into the sun late in the day. And, you know, there was a bad glare in the water. But, you know, there's no excuses. He was a little choppy, but he two-whistled the water blind from the water all the way down the shore through the little. And the only reason why he blew two whistles was I put him in that little grass that they really wanted him, that he was probably going to rub the edge. But I really pushed all mine up into that grass because they said they liked that. And, you know, outside of that, that was two extra whistles. I'm not sure if that cost anything. But, you know, he was a little choppy up front, and then he did a good job.
And how Ember, you know, she was choppy up front, choppy at the little island there with the scent on it. And then once she got past that, it was right there. So with that, like, comment that we're both talking about right now, figuring out the judges and what they want. I think anyone who's listening to this that wants to compete with their dogs, that's something that you have to think about. You know, even if it's a weekend test, you know, there are ideas that a judge likes and doesn't like. I've seen judges drop people for a dog that drops the bird at their feet, picks it up, drops it at their feet, picks it up, drops it at their feet, and then they take it. I actually don't have a problem with that, right? Like, if you're a master hunter, you better deliver to hand. Don't drop it six times and have me say fetch six times, you know. But I've also seen hundreds of other judges let that slide and that dog gets a master pass. Or, you know, the first series where we had to run that poison bird, and if the dog was to the left of the hay bale, you're out. And if it's to the right of the hay bale, you're in. But realistically, if you're 5 feet here or 5 feet there, that's the line to the blind, you know. In a lot of aspects, a lot of judges would let that slide. There's no way in hell I would have let my dog get to the left of that hay bale. Because out, dude. You know, it's just you. So you have to play to what you're seeing the judges judge and be strategic as a handler to put your dog in a position to pass.
Absolutely. And that's in all sporting events. You know, NFL player, a college football player, they're whatever the referee does. I mean, they're going to look at them and say, well, they're letting the cornerbacks get a little, you know, touchy on the corners and the wide receivers. They can push a little more. They know how to play the officials as well. And we have to do the same way. It's not that we're trying to cheat. We're trying to do the best job these judges want from us, essentially. So we're trying to show them what they want.
Exactly.
That's all we're trying to do.
Showing the strengths that our dogs have and managing the situation in front of us. But anyways, all right. So now we're on to the third series. That was a bit of a butt kicker. And when you're looking at it, it really wasn't that hard.
No, it was not. I did not think it was bad when we first watched it.
Yeah, we first watched it. I was like, yeah, we got this. And then son of a gun.
That right-hand bird, man. It was hard, especially with the way the shadows were on the first day and the second day towards the end. And, you know, we had that big wind that was changing a little bit here and there. But that right-hand bird, I think, to me, was the hardest bird out of all my dogs. I couldn't pick up the far right bird. The go bird was pretty good on the island. And the middle bird, I got the middle bird pretty good. I went for it and got it second pretty good. But the right-hand bird, man, I had dogs up in the trees behind it. Like, we've never thrown a bird in some thick woods before.
Yeah. The only dog that had a hard time on that was Memphis, and she didn't see the middle bird. Everybody else picked it up clean for me, and I don't even remember the order I picked it up in, to be honest with you. I'm trying to rack my brain. I think I did go bird on the island, left-hand bird, then right bird. But, I mean, they were dropping dogs for cheating the water and
and
I get that, dude. I get it. I mean, that's clearly get in the water and go get it.
Yeah, and I think we lost, you know, there was some really nice dogs that were dropped there and rightfully so dropped. Like, they didn't do the work, they double handled or they performed very, very poorly. But you know, doing the remote send or remote sit, we didn't have to send, man, that some of them dogs were worried up there. And they didn't see birds. They didn't do what they normally would do. So the little things like that is essentially we lost some pretty nice dogs because of it.
Yeah. Yep. Fourth series. We went to the new Spickles.
Absolutely. And that flyer, we had what, like a 70-yard shot flyer at times.
Yeah. The thing was, I shot flyers. Trying to think, the second day maybe I shot flyers for several hours, and it was dog after dog after dog that would be within feet of it, dude. Feet right on top of it and couldn't smell it. And so, what I think, arid conditions, dry, the dirt was sand and grass. So you've got no moisture there for the dogs to get some scent in the area. I mean, there's feathers everywhere, but they were marking that bird. I mean, they were on it, and they would just run right past it and run right past it and run right past it. They could not dig that sucker out. And dog after dog, I'm sitting there going, you got to be kidding me. Like, please pick this up. Please pick this up. Please pick this up. And it just was way more difficult. Like, I thought at the line, you know, dogs were struggling, but then sitting there and being 15 feet from the dog and watching it hunt its butt off and being a nose away from it and can't smell it was shocking to me.
Yep. And I hit the fourth pretty good. I didn't lose anybody. I didn't handle anybody. Did a really nice job. But, man, the flyer, I imagine being out there at the flyer station, it didn't look like it, but it seemed like some of them flyers would literally fly 70 yards from the line. They were big because the wind was kind of getting behind them right there and carrying them a good ways. But, you know, that was a good test with the short bird thrown underneath the bottom of it.
Yep. Yeah. So we'll describe it. I'll describe it real quick. So it was left-hand bird thrown left to right at maybe 65, 70 yards, 165-yard flyer. down, and it's like slightly down a little hill, and it's what we would refer to as a hip pocket. So the short bird was thrown into the, you know, hip pocket. I hate describing hip pocket because I don't know how else to describe it, but left to right, flyer was left to right. And so they were just offline, offset from each other, long flyer, and then a sharp angle back, right to left, go bird. So you go pick that up. Then you had to know off of the short bird, run a blind behind the gun, which actually got a few dogs. It was way easier than our first series, but it still got several dogs. Then come back, pick up your short bird, hopefully. But there was some other terrain features that we ran into that screwed us. There was a flight that ran there before. And so, you know, 130 dogs running a straight line creates a herd path. And that herd path could take them into no man's land and basically to the flyer. And if they, you know, it just, it screwed them up. And luckily the wind saved most of the dogs, but there were some dogs that it just completely screwed. And then we saw dogs go out on that really had been doing a good job, but just bobbled it. I think the only dog I had messed that up, but still, you know, pass was Quinn. She overran the go bird by a country mile and had to hunt her way back. I think she's just a little too excited and just overran it and figured it out. So you didn't lose anybody in the fourth?
No, I didn't lose anybody in the fourth. I handled one dog, and that was the Cappy dog. And that was on the short check down bird. He actually overran it the first time and went and got the flyer.
Right. He probably took that herd path.
Yep, he did. And he had he went out there and got it. He come back in, and I thought he stepped on it. And I thought he was going to go back to the blind. So I went ahead and put a quick handle on him because he checked down, but he just kind of went towards the blind old pole, and that's an old fall. I think a lot of people did not understand that as well.
Yeah. So we'll break this down a little bit. A dog, you are automatically eliminated if you go to the old fall. So because the dog picked up a blind there before and the dog goes out for the mark, doesn't find it, and then bails off to the where the blind was planted, that's an old fall, automatic out. So you'd have to handle to keep them from doing that. If it was a mark and they go back to that, you're automatically out. So you've got to handle and get them out of that situation. Yeah, you got to do it. You can't risk that he's going to figure it out. You have to put them on the bird. So good, safe handle.
Yep. And come out there and, you know, I needed a good fifth series with him. I didn't want to lose him, but he ended up getting it done. And then I ended up getting everybody through. I lost all the dogs in the second, and I lost one in the third series, and that was all I lost. So the fifth was a doozy. And that big water bird across there was not bad. I had one dog have a pretty rough handle, but still got through it. But that little short bird in front of the water, that scared me to death.
I lost Hunter on that one. So I went, I passed 4 of 6, and I had 5 of 6 going into the fifth. I woke up that day feeling good. I left that feeling like shit.
Yeah, that was, and it was over the short go bird that was in front of the water. But, you know, it was just so, I would never throw that bird like there in training. So it kind of, you know, maybe I should have, but maybe I shouldn't. However, I didn't pick it up very good. I had dogs hunt on it, different stuff. But I essentially, you know, just survived that series and made it out and went 9 for 12.
Good for you, man. 9 for 12. That's a whole successful fall. Good for you. Congratulations to you and Mossy Pond and all your clients. Training for these big national events is kind of stressful. You want the dogs to peak at the right time. You want them to feel good about themselves, yet completely under control. Because running these amount of events without an e-collar on, without being able to recall and resend, you know, whatever we do in training, all of a sudden they just get looser and looser and looser, and it's tough. So to go from the crown to the grand to the national and have that kind of success is kudos to your training.
And we work really hard, and, you know, we come straight home and we bust a tail and had a good training group. I trained with Jimmy Rogers and for the national, trained with Jimmy Rogers and Adam Campbell. And, you know, we worked hard on the simple stuff, which is control, and over the basics. You know, the dog, if you ain't going to teach it to mark the week of training, it's just not going to happen. But we can teach it to sit there and be steady and hope to build a little confidence by being steady. And that's the one thing I always, even on a regular weekend test, steadiness is key to me. If the dog ends up not marking or goes out because it fell on a blind, you know, that's one thing. But we can get the dog to sit, essentially. If we're going to sign it up, it should sit.
Yeah, I agree.
And when a dog breaks, I think that hurts me more than dog on any other thing. Because I know I could have worked a little harder on, you know, maybe throw a flyer in its face in training or do breaking bird drills, do just different things that I might could have done that I didn't do just to get him to sit still. Because obviously it was told to me one time before that even my 80-year-old grandma knows that if the dog breaks, he's out. She don't know he's out. Just because you handle twice, she don't understand none of that. But if it goes there before it while the bird's in the air, it can tell it's out.
Uh-huh. That's hilarious. So yeah.
I don't want a break. That's my main goal. So I didn't have no breaks and none of them. So I was pleased.
Good. Yeah. All right. Let's real quick, because you had mentioned it earlier, being able to take some of these dogs on their first hunt, like high accolades, Mr. Cappy, SRS champ. Cappy went on his first real duck hunt at Mossy Pond. I'd like to end, you know, the podcast with some tips and tricks to help a dog out in their first season, no matter how well trained they are, or if they're a basic dog that's just learning everything right now.
You know, so the most basic thing that a 10-month-old dog that's just done 4 months of training, or an 8-year-old that won the crown championship this year, the one thing he has to do is sit there. And the main thing is for safety of the dog, safety for the hunt, so steadiness. And I just did some drills the other day with splash, putting the dog on a dog stand, splashing birds out in front of them, you know, shooting across there, blowing a bunch of duck calls. But I treat a dog's first hunt, no matter the age, as if I need to train him to do every single thing in the hunting environment. I go in there, I do not carry a gun. I sit there with him and I let, you know, I talk to him. I leash him up if I need to. If he gets a little antsy, I'll put a leash on him. I don't care if he's 8. I want that first hunt to be the most successful hunt. The first bird killed, if it sells and goes into the woods or goes way off, we're not going to pick that one up. You know, with that first bird's got to be the most successful bird to me. We get the ones that's laid out there in the decoys. We'll start on them. We don't come out running a poison bird blind on the first hunt. You know, it's just not going to set me up. I'm going to go out there. And then maybe at the end, if we had a good hunt, I'll go pick up some on a blind. But I want everything to be as controlled as possible. And, you know, I give tips to anybody. You know, if you got the dog that's really steady and he can sit there through the hunt, then you're halfway done there. The next part is pick up the simple birds. Then you can worry about the hard stuff later. So the birds that fall out there in the decoys, you know, go ahead and get them. But don't waste your time running a 300-yard blind on the first hunt.
Right.
And you might can at the very end of the hunt, but let's don't do it midway to hunt and booger it all up.
Yeah.
You know, just keep it simple. Keep it simple and stick to the basics. You know, sit means sit, so you can always use it. Now, one thing I always do is when the first volley of birds come in, I'll be standing beside the dog. I tell them to sit. I don't just trust them.
Yep.
I carry bumpers with me when I'm hunting, and, you know, especially a young dog, a dog that's on his first season of hunting, maybe a year-old dog. We get into the duck blind, or we get into the – put him on a dog stand in the timber, wood duck hole. If it's real slow, I'll throw some bumpers out there for him. I want them to be almost training inside the hunting environment then, because a dog gets bored. It's just like us. We start getting lackadaisical and we start doing things we shouldn't, and then they learn bad habits. So one thing I always do is I carry some bumpers with me and keep them tuned up in the hole.
I agree. I think that's a phenomenal tip, because we do the same. We'll have a bumper in our blind bag. And if it's boring and slow and they don't get to do anything because it's a classic lone duck day. We didn't get the name lone duck for shooting a pile of them, but you've got that bumper to, you know, have your buddy jump up and shoot and you whip a bumper out of the boat or whatever. Just give that dog some sense of, I sat here for 2-3 hours and didn't do jack. Let me go do something. And then you're reinforcing all that you've trained to have a successful day, even though the birds aren't in the strap. It's something for that dog. I 100% agree having controlled the dog that sits still and whatever. I 100% agree with shooting birds that are decoying, not sky busting and have them sail 300 yards. And I also, you know how ducks will fly in at first light and we'll water swat them at like, all right, you know, 3, 2, 1, all right, take them, boys. And you water swat the first round, you know, type of deal. Well, what did that dog didn't learn jack. It didn't see anything fall. It didn't see anything. It's dark out. And so, you know, just be conscious of it. I'm not telling you not to shoot because my trigger finger is itchy too, but be conscious of your dog's first few hunts. I'd rather sacrifice that one bird and the next one cups up and the dog watches it and it falls in the water and it goes and gets it. And then the second thing, I've been humbled a ton, which I would love to hear if you had any humble pie stories on these hunts where it's like Cappy, the SRS champ. But I took one of my dogs, Prairie. Last year was her first season. She's like 2 years old, runs blinds, you know, dang near a master hunter, and now is a master hunter, but never hunted before. Shot a beautiful, happened to be banded, Drake Mallard. Dead in the decoys, dude. I could have hawked a loogie and hit it. Kicking, feet up. Center, she swims out, swims to the mojo, swims 3 circles, and came back to the boat. I'm like, you got to be shitting me. Kicked her loose again. She jumps in, no pressure, no nothing. We kind of like laughed about how embarrassing this is. You know, professional dog trainer Bob, dog can't go pick up a 10-yard mark. Jumps in the water, goes and gets it. Never screwed up again. It just didn't click. So don't lose your patience. Throw them a rock. Help them figure it out. And all of a sudden, all the pieces of the puzzle that you've been putting together in training will start to click. It might be bird 1. It might be bird 10. But it's a different. There's not a bird boy throwing a mark. There's not a winger. There's not a boom gun. There's not a, you know, it's just different. They're sitting there for an hour and a half, and all of a sudden, bang, one gunshot goes off, and they see a splash, and they're looking at the person over here who shot the gun and have no clue what happened. Help them out. Coach them up.
Yep, absolutely. And, you know, don't expect, oh, they're a Grand Hunt Retriever champion, Master National Hall of Fame, that they're going to do it perfect. Because, I mean, have you ever trained them for that? We've been training for the competitions, not that. So, yeah, I have a little story about, I had a dog named Red that I run the SRS with. He's a Grand Hunt Retriever champion, Master National Hunter. Man, we took him hunting the other day, and he got off into the on a crippled bird, and I was like, surely, I mean, this is nothing for him. It was the first bird, too, of the day he picked up pretty good, and the next bird was crippled right behind it in the same spot, and he chased it around. Well, unwillingly known that he was about 300 yards on the up, about 2 duck holes over before I finally found him again. You know, that the old here command went bye-bye there.
Yeah.
So, you know, just little things like that, I was like, man, I look really embarrassed. I'm sitting here with a bunch of clients.
Yeah.
And I can't even get the dog to come back to me. I had to crank the boat up and go down the boat ditch to go get him.
Yeah, I've been there.
So I put him back in there. And, you know, after that, we spoke to the birds inside the hole for a little bit. And we'll go back next time. But, you know, luckily for me, I get to take dogs on different types of hunts. You know, we do upland pheasant and upland quail. Well, I took a dog quail hunting the other day, a Grand Hunt Retriever champion, that I would thought would be awesome at upland hunting. Took her on a quail hunt, sent her after it, and man, she run 200 yards before she ever stopped. When I called her name, I was like, what the crap? The bird dogs are pointed at like 15 yards.
Yeah.
And she just kept running. She's like, I think, and then I got thinking about it. I was like, in her mind, she thought she was running until she did, you know, got a bird.
Or got a whip.
Them quail.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I was like, all right. So, man, knowing that them dogs have no clue about what them bird dogs are doing in front of them, it really showed me that, man, these dogs, the dogs that do it really good, and you're like, wow, that's a really nice dog that's flushing for these birds. man, they understand that them bird dogs are pointing a bird. So they read that dog and they hunt beside the bird dogs.
Yeah, it's contact.
You know,
right?
Same thing duck hunting. Yep. You know, never put a, how often do we get to put a dog in a boat and ride it down a boat ditch and go all through the woods and then show up and throw decoys out in front of, you can't train for that stuff. So obviously the first hunt, there's a lot of new stuff. We want to keep it basic and simple. And then once the dog gets acclimated to all that, you know, then you can start getting into your fun stuff. You can start knowing it off of birds and, you know, picking up the things, but just nobody has a big dog trainer facility cannot train for the time management, stuff like that.
That's right. I have another funny one. So Memphis, who made it in the Hall of Fame this year. So again, high accolade, great dog, hunted a bunch. We were in Maryland hunting black ducks in this little cove. And we shoot one. And it's crippled. And if you can picture the cove with a couple little peninsulas, like fingers, like badass place to train, really. Well, the live one, crippled, is swimming and diving on her all over this point. All over it. She finally gets it. Comes back. Next bird we have gets shot and lands on top of the point. 10 feet. Belly up on land. 10 feet from where she was chasing that cripple. What do you think she did?
Oh, yeah. She wasn't going back to the old fall.
No, dude. She did. She wouldn't get back on land because she's like, I just had the most fun chasing this cripple right here. Yeah. And she's like, it landed right back where this other one was. I mean, it was only a few feet, but it was on land.
So she started chasing again.
Oh, chasing. Like, it's, and like, you know, putting her head underwater. Like, it's got to be here. It's got to be here. I'm in it. And just absolutely, you know, I mean, if she just turned around and looked for 1 second, she'd see it, you know, one jump over here. And we were laughing / super embarrassed that I couldn't hit this dog. She kept putting her head underwater. Like, I'm going to catch it. I'm going to catch it. Nope, it's not there. So they will humble you. They will make you wonder what, you know, 8 years of dog training has done. And so if you expect your 10-month-old to be perfect on its first duck hunt, I promise you something screwy will happen. So stay patient, have fun. To your point earlier, the basics are important. Steadiness for the safety of the dog and the other hunters. Steadiness is paramount. Mark the birds, you know, all that stuff is super, super important. So anything else, Carter, how can people find you, man? You got a little Instagramming and Mossy Ponding. How can people find you and your team there?
Yep, we're on Facebook primarily. I do use Instagram, Mossy Pond Retrievers or Carter Turner. You can find me on a bunch of hunt tests as well, but you know, we're in Southeast Georgia, and if anybody's ever that way, more than welcome to stop in and train. And you know, we love having different people in because we get, I'm learning every day, and I love spending time with other dog trainers because somebody might have one tip that can make me better. And you know, everybody's getting better. These dogs are getting better. The game's getting essentially easier or harder because they're having to come up with stuff because we've gotten so good. The dogs have gotten so talented, bred so well that, you know, we got to keep evolving our own self and our own training methods to keep up with the evolution of these dogs, how good they're taking off. So, you know, Mossy Pond Retrievers in Patterson, Georgia, or look me up on Carter Turner on Facebook.
Absolutely, man. Well, congratulations to you on an extremely successful year and fall. I mean, to go 1-3-5 at the SRS, smash the Grand and smash the Master National. I'm happy for you. I'm proud of you. You work your butt off and you're a good dude and fun to hang out with. I'm glad you got to join us on an episode, and I hope to have you on again, man.
Absolutely. And maybe when you come down this winter, we'll run up Blaine's and hang out one day.
Yeah, we'll go hang out with old Biggs. Boykin.
I've ventured out to the Boykin game, and I'm trying to get him back from Blaine. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. He keeps wanting a training for me. I don't know.
I'd let him train it, dude. Screw that.
I know. That's kind of the reason why he's there.
Absolutely. Well, hey, man, thank you so much for joining us. You have a great evening. We'll catch you soon. Hey, do me a solid. If you enjoy the show, if you enjoy our Instagram, if we've helped you at all, join patreon.com/loneduckoutfitters. If you do it before September of 2023, you're going to enter to win a hunt with me and Kevin and a bunch of other Patreon members down in Missouri. We're going to smack some ducks, have some fun, do a seminar with our dogs, and have a great time. But jump into patreon.com/loneduckoutfitters. Links in the description. And join the community that helps me help you help your dog.
Hey, listeners, Nick Larson here, host of the Birdshot Podcast. As fans of this show, you may be interested in the conversations on the Birdshot Podcast, where we discuss all things upland hunting, from upland birds and their habitat and conservation to the shotguns, bird dogs, and gear used to pursue them. Whether you're a seasoned upland hunter or just getting started and wanting to learn more, I interview a wide range of guests, each with their own unique perspective and valuable experience to share. If you're on the hunt for more upland hunting conversation, please consider subscribing to the Birdshot Podcast today. We'll be right back.